You make payments on a monthly basis, and you provide us with the data of what you are playing. So, you know, when you think about it, there's very low transaction cost. The biggest cost actually involved is for Sound Exchange to track down all of the rights holders and all of the performers who are owed royalties. We are much more of the edge of the music business than the center. Yes, we have all the major artists and all the major labels, but online, in the digital world, I think Joe Kennedy at Pandora this morning mentioned how many different artists they play. You know, on the radio, you hear the same 30 artists every 3 hours. On Pandora, you hear 40,000 artists a day or 90,000 artists a day, and we have to track them down. No one tells us who those artists are other than a name. I remember the first time I saw the artist named Rigo Starr, R-I-G-O-S-T-A-R-R. I thought, oh, this is a misspelling of Ringo. No, it's an African guitar player. So you have to be very careful before you jump to conclusions and pay the wrong people. But, you know, I was thinking about competition, and it kind of reminded me one of my former board members at Sound Exchange. He was a very fine record producer. He owned a small independent label. He sold his label 5 years ago, and now he works selling fish. And 3 months into selling fish, he called me up, and he was very upset. And he said, you know, when someone wants salmon, they call you up, but they can call several suppliers to get salmon, and each of them compete till they get the best price. But in the music industry, if you need the group Leftover Salmon, there is only one company that holds those rights. Or if you're building a music store, you can't only offer leftover salmon. You must also offer fish and trout fishing in America and hot tuna and many, many thousands of other artists. So if we are really going to try to have a celestial global jukebox, if Pandora in the United States can play every single work ever released, which they can under a statutory license, you will need every recording ever made in the future. And licensing has always been the biggest hurdle to getting all of that repertoire. How many licenses does it require to get all of the repertoire ever recorded? Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, more likely it's millions. Now, rights owners, in their desire to be included on many sites, have actually provided their rights to digital aggregators, and we see quite a bit of that at Sound Exchange. These are aggregators who hold the rights to thousands and thousands of rights owners. It's a start. Now maybe 100 licenses can provide you 85 to 90% of all the content. But a service with just those 100 licenses is still at peril because of the edge. The first right in 1995 was a very small beginning for us. We are continuing to fight for greater rights for recording artists in the United States. As many of you know, we are not a signatory to the Rome Convention because we do not provide broadcast rights from our biggest earner from the use of sound recordings, broadcast radio. We thought we were close 2 weeks ago to having a deal with broadcast radio, and it seems to have fallen apart, as did our elections 2 days ago. We have the compulsory license that allows services like internet radio and satellite radio to prevail in the U.S. and to grow. The need for these licenses, though, is somewhat problematic, I think, because when we got our rights, the quid pro quo, the bargain that was struck with Congress, was that the license had to be compulsory. No one could withhold their content. Every recording is available. Users are protected from liability if they make payments and report accurately. So you cannot bring a lawsuit saying you can't use my content. All content can be used. The problem then becomes one of how do you set rates in that situation? Sound Exchange has an antitrust exemption to engage with all of the users to set prices for the industry, representing everyone. It is not an easy process. If we can't reach voluntary licenses with the users, then we go to rate court, similar to every other collecting society around the world. We have three judges, copyright royalty judges, in the United States who set those rates. It's always important to remember that when those judges set rates, they should set the rates for Hey Jude as the compulsory license rate, not for my record, which came out in 1971. You have to set it at the highest rate for the most valuable work because that's what's going to be performed, or that's what can be performed. We get a lot of negative criticism about that, but I think you have to take that in consideration when setting compulsory licenses where users are allowed to play whatever they want. So I think, you know, it's good that under a compulsory licensing system, the competition is reserved for services competing against each other because their transaction costs are very low. On the other hand, I am always reticent to take the right away from someone to license their own product or to accept a rate that is imposed upon them. We've seen in the United States, under the compulsory license, as I said, a very wonderful growth in streaming services that is not present anywhere else in the world. And I think it's important that as the industry changes and digital rights become the central right that we are all concerned with, and the physical continues to go away, that we must receive very good rates for the use of our work in streaming services. It is not our business to provide work below market so that someone else's business model can succeed. Their business model may have problems. Maybe there is no business model. Maybe it's just an exit strategy that when I aggregate this many fans, I will be able to sell using our content to build the value in their business and then us never seeing the value in that sale. So I think it is it's a cautionary tale, and yet it is an exciting one. We are very excited that next year we will probably cross the $300 million range as streaming in the United States continues to grow. And hopefully we will have a broadcast right with radio. Maybe we'll be at $400 million. But we will keep you posted on those details, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. John.
Right. I'm sorry, I didn't introduce him to you. Mr. John Simpson, Executive Director, Sound Exchange of Washington, D.C. Now we are going to give the floor to Mr. Flavio Burbano, Director, Ecuador National Directorate of Copyrights and Related Rights, Quito. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I would like to begin on my behalf and behalf of the Ecuadorian Institute of Intellectual Property and the American Institute of Development of Copyright. I would like to congratulate WIPO, and I would like to thank WIPO for having invited me. This forum is a clear-cut signal that we're trying to achieve a balance, a so desired balance in the intellectual property world. I'm going to talk about my region, my institution, which is present here, an interaction between copyright and competition. I would like to begin with one topic, and I would call it an anxiety to have access. Anxiety, I think it occurs everywhere, but in Latin America, I can tell you, I can talk about it more directly, there is a real need of the user to have access to content. And I have a quote from Tibetan Buddhism. It says,
You would send a letter and not expect a reply for 6 months. Now, if people send an email and don't get a reply in 30 seconds, they get angry.
And I think that I'm summing up what it said. The user wants it right away, wants to have access to the content right away, the song, the film, CD. It's a reality. In Latin America and most of the region, there is a lack of legal access. There is a lack of legal offer of the product. So we have many consumers who say, I want to have access now, I want to pay, but simply I just can't. And something was said about this morning, this lack of access, which is not just a problem in Latin America. And I would like to say that I am convinced, 100% convinced, that much of the problem of piracy, not of course the whole problem, but a great part of it, is a lack of access. And I also have a quotation from a user. He told me the following, I want a song, and I want it right now. If I can have access to it paying a reasonable price, I'll do it. If not, I'll have access to it illegally. He's not a delinquent. He's not someone who doesn't want to comply with the law. He's just a user. He's a music fanatic, and he wants to have access to his music. Unfortunately, I repeat, in most of our countries in the Latin American region, there isn't that possibility. I'm not saying that it's inexistent. I'm just saying that it's a very, very limited access. And that's the first premise that I wanted to highlight. Now, the second is, as a response to that, to the lack of access, and through the big record companies, multinationals, not just of music, but also other types of works, there are undertakings, independent undertakings in Latin America, which are very similar to iTunes, but focused on the local author, the local regional author, and the independent author who's trying to use internet so that his product be well known. And I brought several examples in my country. We have an undertaking. These are very small SMEs or even big companies, but which have an independent focus, which is in container region. Ecuador, we have a company called Wawa Music. And Wawa Music is a company is dedicated to say to the author, bring us your song, put it on internet, give us a license to distribute it in a flexible manner, and then we'll pay you for what we can sell through this service. Now, it's a company made up of young people. They're just beginning. And each and every time, bit by bit, they're growing. It's getting better. They're benefiting from the situation. But do have a problem, which I also mentioned this morning, which is sometimes finding the rights holder to have the possibility of speaking with a big group of authors. And that is where these collective management organizations do very well. And I'm going to mention them further on. I just want to give you some more examples. There's also something called Baja Music, which is not from Ecuador, but from the region. And Bandcamp is more well-known, a little bigger, but it has that focus too. Then Solido Local, another company. All these are internet companies so that there be access through internet to works, especially musical works. As I said, in the region, there isn't a greater access yet. So I was saying that it's very important for this kind of enterprise or undertaking that it have a relationship with the authors, it give access to the authors or to the rights holders, and to achieve agreements which will enable for an access we don't have today. And as I said, the collective management organizations can be very, very important indeed. I'm going to read you a quotation from the main director of the company that I just mentioned. This Ecuadorian company of independent SaaS is one of the main obstacles which we have found in the undertaking Guagua Music is the direct negotiation with the independent authors to be able to find the music offer. The same musicians don't know about the possibility of being part of a sustainable musical market. They don't know about their rights, and they're not accustomed to work hand in hand with the system, which doesn't give them the information necessary to come to them. Sometimes they adapt, finally, and then they're part of the problem. They don't live of their music, of their art. So the collective management organizations can be a very important pillar to strengthen communication and facilitate commercial relations between distributors and artists. And this is something I really do agree with. This is a general manager of this company that I mentioned, Wawa Music. And then comply with this idea of a link with the competition and copyright is a very important case that occurred in Chile a few years ago. A possible legal conflict that existed between the collective management organizations and the right competition law in countries. There's just one collective management organization per gender or kind of work. That's not the case everywhere, but it's quite common in Latin America. And what I wanted to bring to, the reference I wanted to bring to, and this is what the National Economic Prosecutor resolved in Chile, where there says in Chile just one collective management organization, and the prosecutor said, in Chile, it's just one collective management organization which administers public communication rights of musical works and phonograms, and therefore one has created a monopolistic situation which permits or allows for abusive behavior. And therefore, rates must be set by mutual agreements by the interested parties, or if not possible, then through an arbitral tribunal whose integration, faculties, and procedures are determined by law. Chile has just reformed its law in 2010, adopting this resolution, this dissolution of the general prosecution as prosecutor as regards competition and those systems. There isn't an agreement between the users, the rights holder. We create or establish an arbitral tribunal. That's a very good example for a region. In our region, it's not the norm to have this kind of system, but the management organization establishes its rate, and that's it. And I think it's very, very welcome for the region to have that resolution of conflicts in the case where there's an agreement by having these arbitral tribunals, etc. To conclude, a very interesting solution for the region could be, on the one hand, to encourage the participation of collective management organizations in negotiations with web portals, which promote the legal distribution of musical works through internet, especially local authors. In our case, we have to promote our authors, of course. On the other hand, to use the Chilean model or any other similar model to avoid possible violations of the competition law. Thank you.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, Mr. Flavio. Now we give the floor to Tilman Luder, Head Copyright Unit, European Commission, Brussels.
Thank you very much. Thank you also for the invitation to the WIPO. I have spent many pleasurable hours in this room, sitting at the back where the NGOs are. That's where usually the European Commission sits, representing the member states. And, thank you also for the introduction. I am the head of the European Commission's Copyright Unit. And in that function, I'm principally responsible for drafting of the European copyright laws. And the issue that we're going to discuss today, how to improve licensing for innovative and modern online services, might also require a legislative approach, and that is why my unit is involved in this debate. I want to basically talk about three issues today. What would be the ideal situation, at least from how I see it? This is, by the way, a strictly personal address. I'm talking here in my private capacity, how I see the world, how I would do it if I were in charge. You all know that I'm actually not in charge, that I have many bosses in the European Commission, and that ultimately it is the commissioners, this is the body that governs the European Commission, who will decide this, and not the head of the copyright unit. But I'll talk first about the ideal situation. How could we organize the copyright licensing for online uses? Then I will talk about the real situation, how it presents itself as we speak. And then just to round it off, if we still have time, I will talk about some worst-case nightmare scenarios that are also rather likely to happen. Now, ideally, it's a story of missed opportunities, I would say, at least for the European Union. And I will principally, of course, address this issue from the perspective of the European Union. But I'm not naive in thinking that what happens in the European Union is actually the center of the world. Far from it. It's possible just that if the European Union, which in a very confined space on this globe, already has to reconcile 27 legal systems and 27 member states, if we would come up with something, it might just be possible that this is of interest for some other jurisdictions as well, once they see that internet licensing is actually not a national issue. Internet licensing is a regional or possibly even a global issue. So I will talk about the ideal state of affairs first. In 1996, as you all know, we had the WIPO treaties, and I think there we missed the trick when the WIPO treaties were transposed into the laws of the European Union, because we should have introduced some of the new copyright that was created in the WIPO treaties, not as a national copyright title, but we should have introduced it as a European copyright title. And I'm not notably talking, of course, of this new animal that was in the 1996 treaties, the so-called interactive making available right. There was no interactive making available right in any of the national laws. Arguably, some were interpreted to cover also interactive making available, but there was no specific provision in any of the 27 national laws at the time. So it would have been a brilliant stroke of genius, but of course I wasn't there yet. It would have been a brilliant stroke of genius to say, we will introduce a making available right in Europe for online transactions, which would need to be licensed on a pan-territorial basis, but we will introduce it as a new European copyright title, not as 27 national titles, which are worded identically, but are only valid for a national territory, but as a European making available title, which can be licensed in one single transaction across the entire Union. That would have been brilliant. I think that probably 50% of people here would disagree with me, but anyway, I think that would have been brilliant. That would have created a new title, which you could trade, which you could sell. You could sell your rights in this making available right, but you could not sell it for the United Kingdom in isolation to one party, for Spain in isolation to another party, and then for the Baltic countries to a third party, which introduces what we heard this morning as the fragmentation of ownership, which then, of course, leads to the cry, we need to have a global repertoire database. So what would have been the advantages of the single title? As I said, one title, it can be transferred for all of Europe in one transaction, but you cannot fragment the market, you can't split the title into 27 different transactions, so that in 27 jurisdictions, potentially, there will be 27 different owners of this copyright. Second advantage, there would have been a single license. There would have been a single license for a service like iTunes, for a service like Spotify, or for any other service which has a vocation to serve everybody in Europe and not just in one of its member states. And with a single transaction, for instance, the making available rights to a musical composition could have been licensed across the European Union. And the third advantage is we would have finally created a European title also for copyright. We have one for trademarks, for instance, for industrial property. Some of my colleagues are working hard on other single industrial property titles, but we have never, ever breached this frontier for copyright. And in a sense, I have to be quite honest about this, in the European Commission, due to the absence of such a single title, copyright is a bit the poor cousin of the industrial property. Ideal situation. We come to the real situation. Well, there is ownership fragmentation. There is not a single title. We need, therefore, a global repertoire database. We, therefore, have this constant issue that we don't know who owns what. We have the constant issue of that different people own different rights in different territories. And we have, it was mentioned this morning as well, an ongoing battle between so-called direct licensing initiative and, on the other hand, collective rights management. Direct licensing basically says, I own a particular publishing right in a particular song, I'm going to directly license it across the Union. But then, as we heard this morning, you'll have to reconcile the coexistence of such direct licenses with the rest of the rights which are collectively managed, and at the moment they're still collectively managed territory by territory. So that's the real situation. Thirdly, what would be the nightmare situation and what we're trying to avoid? The nightmare situation for many people, and again, this is entirely subjective, maybe some people here in the room would say that my nightmare is actually the ideal situation. But anyway, from the perspective of most of my colleagues in the European Commission and also in the stakeholder community, the nightmare situation is that we replace 27 national monopolies with a single European monopoly. Of course, it sounds, on the face of it, very attractive to say there is all this repertoire fragmentation in the European Union. We will re-aggregate. So the big cry is now for re-aggregation of repertoire. Well, the best way, of course, to re-aggregate all repertoire in a single licensing point is, of course, to create a European monopoly collecting society. And then you would force also the recalcitrant publishers who have licensed their rights separately in a direct licensing deal to go back into that portal. Or you would say the portal is voluntary. but it's a monopoly. Most people in my institution think that a monopoly would be a bad idea. Licensing transactions would be slowed. There would be a panoply of tariff negotiations, monopolies. It is said, it is alleged. It's not my personal view, of course. I'm just repeating what other people say. Monopolies react slowly sometimes if you want to launch innovative services, which needs individualized tariff schemes. Monopolies usually have fixed and standardized tariffs which don't fit a Spotify, which don't fit a new service. Monopolies maybe have now come up with a download tariff, but now we heard this morning that streaming is the latest thing, so are monopolies going to quickly come up with differentiated streaming tariffs? Possibly that would be a problem. Of course, the other worst-case scenario for many people is that if we don't manage to re-aggregate repertoire, and if we still say that it should be licensed at European level, then we'll have only direct licensing deals. So we will only have publishers licensing their repertoire directly for the European Union, individual collecting societies licensing their repertoire for the European Union. We have a joint venture between the Pablo next to me can talk about that some more, but possibly Pablo can license his repertoire directly across the European Union as well, as if he were a publisher. So we have a total fragmentation, but we have pan-European licensing. Nobody's happy with that either. That's why my commissioner has proposed a framework directive, and I might reveal bits and pieces of that directive if there are questions afterwards. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thielmann. Next, Mr. Rob Kirken, and Copyright Contracting Talent and Rights Negotiation Group, BBC. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thanks to WIPO for giving me the opportunity to set out some brief views from a BBC perspective. Our overall theme is facilitating access to culture in the digital age. And the BBC believes that a copyright system fit for the digital world would balance strong copyright protection with straightforward licensing of all types of copyright material, not only music, and that the competition rules should support this balanced approach. We understand the need for strong copyright protection because the BBC is a major rights holder and creator of intellectual property itself. £2.3 billion per annum is spent by the organisation on producing, commissioning or acquiring original content. Creativity is therefore the lifeblood of an organisation like mine, and the scale of this investment illustrates the importance of copyright in incentivising and protecting creativity. Based on our experience as a major user and licensee of rights, we also believe it is vital to have copyright rules which promote efficient and cost-effective licensing so that the creative and cultural work we invest in can be easily disseminated. For a modern broadcasting organisation like the BBC, there are two key drivers in the digital age for seeking copyright licensing rules which balance strong rights with easy access. The first is audience expectation. In the digital age, broadcasters provide many more audio and audiovisual services than previously and seek to provide them on all digital platforms and device types. Universal access of this kind, however, meets only the basic level of expectation for modern audiences, who also expect broadcast content to be made available anytime, any place, anywhere. And particularly of a public service broadcaster like the BBC, have a legitimate expectation that past archive content will be available as well as current output. The second driver is piracy. If audience expectation cannot be met, a commercial opportunity is effectively created for illegal operators whose activities jeopardise the cultural and economic well-being of all our industries. I will give some brief examples from our practical experiences of where the present rules mean rights licensing has to be carried out in a way that makes it more difficult than necessary to meet audience needs and incurs substantial inefficiency costs. I'd like to suggest some adjustments to the rules and try to take the competition aspects into account. Firstly, the present rules for managing rights clearances result in inefficiencies and are not fully effective because they do not reflect the multi-territory and platform and technology-neutral basis on which broadcasters need to provide audio and audiovisual media services. For example, BBC iPlayer was launched at the end of 2007. This service provides multi-platform simul streams of BBC output and a streamed on-demand catch-up service of recent programmes. It now attracts around 100 million stream requests a month and therefore comes second in the UK to Google YouTube in terms of requests for an on-demand audiovisual service. Now, the next bit is etched on my heart because the negotiations for the rights agreements for the BBC to run iPlayer took 5 years. And they required reaching 70 new agreements with rights holders. And this degree of complexity results from three factors. A, the complex aggregation of copyright interests, particularly in audiovisual material. B, the requirement to separately acquire from rights holders both reproduction and communication to the public rights. And C, the separation of communication to the public rights into broadcasting and making available. Finally, because it is funded by the UK licence fee, iPlayer is directed and limited to UK audiences. To make it available on a multi-territory basis would add another layer of complexity to this matrix. Secondly, as things stand, there will be substantial rights clearance difficulties in making available the BBC's programme archive. We have recent experience of making just 1,000 hours of archive programmes available online for streaming for just a six-month period. 6,500 person hours were spent checking this material for rights implications and subsequently obtaining permission for this use from about 300 individual or collective rights holders. The BBC Television Archive contains about 400,000 hours of programmes, and the programme archives of the members of the European Broadcasting Union, Europe's public service broadcasters, contain many, many millions more. We estimate that clearing the entire BBC archive would require 800 staff working for 3 years at a total cost of £70 million. And in that process, a proportion of archive programmes would prove to be unclearable because copyright works included in them had become orphaned. As an inefficiency cost, particularly in conjunction with the essential costs of digitising and distributing archives, this could result in a substantial shortfall in the realisation of both public and commercial value from facilitating access to broadcasters' archives as a cultural resource. So the main conclusions of the BBC and Europe's other public service broadcasters, based on experiences of this kind, in terms of necessary adjustments to the rules governing copyright clearance arrangements, fall into two broad categories. A, building on the principles established in the regulatory sphere in the EU's Audiovisual Media Services Directive, technology-neutral, multi-territory licensing for online audiovisual media services would be facilitated by extending the so-called country of origin rule on a technologically neutral basis to all initial communications to the public of services like iPlayer. Licensing of audiovisual media communications to the public should incorporate the making of incidental reproductions, technical copies, to reflect the practical reality of broadcasting today. These measures would enable a single rights clearance to suffice for the use of programme contributions across all platforms. Secondly, the revised rules should promote, in our view, the adoption of extended collective licensing schemes where these can be shown to be the most practicable means for clearing rights for audiovisual media services, including the making available of programmes in on-demand services. And in the EU, there should be a binding obligation for member states to ensure, for example, through extended collective licensing, coupled with arrangements to deal with orphan works, that the broadcasters can clear their archives for use in new online services. This would create certainty of use, efficient rights clearance mechanisms, and a basis for the fair remuneration of rights holders. So the two final points to consider are these. Whether the above policy proposals would equally apply to the licensing of music rights as well as other copyright material, and would the approach conflict with the rules on competition? The BBC's current licensing arrangements for music already conform on the basis of voluntary collective licences with many of the policy objectives I've set out. In some respects, the issue is being able to replicate the efficiency of those models for the other 15 or so categories of major rights holders whose material makes up audiovisual works. The one aspect in which the current music licensing arrangements do not conform is, of course, in terms of being able to readily obtain clearances for multi-territory use. This is a necessary improvement to the current rules, but in our view, should not be at the expense of being able to clear rights in the worldwide repertoire for agreed uses via a single collective rights manager. The wider application of collective licensing models advocated here does raise legitimate competition aspects. Individual rights holders and creators would need to have trust and confidence in the collective rights managers, and that would need independent oversight. In addition, the concentration of rights in a single entity should be balanced by access to a price arbitration mechanism for users and licensees, something like the Copyright Tribunal in the United Kingdom, as well as an arbitrator on value for rights holders who can only seek compensation from the collective rights manager under extended collective licensing schemes. For example, a function of the Copyright License Tribunal in Denmark. So to conclude, I have put the BBC's views on copyright licensing into the context of the importance to the BBC of creativity. Equally critical is the changing expectations of audiences in response to digital technology and the threat from piracy if those expectations cannot be met legitimately. I have said that aspects of the copyright licensing system are rooted in historical practices which do not best serve contemporary needs. The BBC will work in collaboration with our creator stakeholders to increase the level of certainty over our ability to use the rights in BBC content and to substantially simplify current rights administration complexity on a fair basis. However, we do think, in relation to some of the intractable problems of individual rights holder clearances, that legal changes to support simplification of the rules and the effective collective management of rights should be part of the future landscape. In this context, competition between collective rights managers would be desirable, provided it is consistent with establishing the most efficient clearance systems. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robb. Bueno, pasamos de pronto para...
And we'll give the floor right away to Mr. Pablo Hernandez, Deputy Director General, Authors and Editors Society, Sociedad de Autores y Editores, SGA, Madrid. Thank you very much. We have a very short period of time, so I don't want to lose any time, but I do want to express thanks to WIPO for inviting me to participate in this meeting. The truth is that we all have nightmares. We all have something that makes us shiver. Now, if we think in terms of competition, It's that somebody can set the price and do so in a collective way, and that several agents will come together, get together, and determine the conditions for access to their works. Copyright has always been the nightmare for competition, but competition, just like copyright, are two elements that seek to build an innovative world where we are investing in new ideas, ideas that are used to obtain a social benefit. Now, if we ask the Nobel Prize winner who studied technologies that form our society and that change our business models, and if we ask Hans and Peter about the origins of copyright and what this technology was when thinking about internet, and he would say that one of the procedures, innovative procedures, curiously enough, was collective management. Collective management, since it was established, allowed authors, and here I'm referring to the play between the authors, the creators of music. Collective management allowed the authors to have an incentive to create music. Talent wasn't that great, but there were people who were devoted to using that talent. And they, just like any of us professionals who have devoted our activity to a certain economic area, that's what they're doing. And the only way to have the authors receive pay for their work is thanks to collective management. And that's what I'm referring to when I speak about these procedures that arose in the 19th century. And they met the market demand. That's why they were established. And Sasha, a few hours ago, explained this, and I'd just like to spend a few seconds time on this. There was the matter of transaction costs. And Lawrence Lessig spoke about the owner. And collective management solves the problem about who to request the license from. And there are market features, market symmetries. We have to receive the license in a short period of time, at low price, with easy access to the repertory of works. And then there needs to be a follow-up for the observance of contracts, enforcement of copyrights. Collective management, which facilitates and provides market access to works, does so, and at the same time sees to it that the price reduces. And one additional work for the collective market would be reduced in price each time. But for us, if we had to carry out the work to grant the license and to enforce respect for the work, if we do this on an individual basis, then the cost involved would be much higher. So that's the advantage of collective management. Professor Towson said that the unit cost of monitoring and enforcing copyrights of thousands of work would decrease based on the number of works. Collective management shifts the benefits both to the market and to the authors in a progressive way based on the acceptance rate in the market itself. And the greater the repertory is, the more attractive this is to the market. If people are looking for the repertory, they see who are the greatest rights holders in the repertory. And when the author notes that there is an organization that offers the possibility to him to license the work and receive remuneration,
the attractiveness of the organization increases, and the author is more interested in becoming part of that organization. So I can speak about those economic benefits, and there are also cultural benefits that ensue from a collective management. And there's an instrument that we know in general terms as a blanket license. This blanket license means that the licensor may use any music piece without increasing the marginal cost. And alongside the benefits, the economic benefits I've referred to, there is a great cultural advantage. What is the cultural advantage? First of all, the user may use the repertory broadly. In economic terms, the inefficient distribution is reduced, and minority use is not penalized. Let's just take an example. If you want to look at the service market, you look at the main rights holders of the works. And the same occurs when we use Google as a search engine. Most of us don't go beyond the third page of sites. We stay in the first three pages under Google. The minority repertories would have difficulty in acceding to the internet windows if the price of access would suppose a higher cost than the main user windows. So this means that the blanket license promotes the generation of new public, new groups of public, because there are market niches that are created. And this is of benefit to cultural diversity. And I think that cultural diversity is also something that has to be discussed here. This mechanism promotes the well-being of the authors. It generates new works. It benefits us. Because the mainstream is not the only stream in the creation of works. To achieve all of these benefits, obviously, we need a pool, a common fund of licenses. To transfer the possibility of providing licenses from one's repertory, and that's what the collective management organizations do. This centralized organization also has the benefit of focusing efforts, investment, R&D, enforcement, supervision, promotion. And I'm not going to go into further detail about the cultural benefits, but there are benefits of collective management organizations in two areas. In the trade union area, and I think that we need to refer to that, and there is also a rebalancing of the negotiating position of the author vis-a-vis the large media companies and the main rights holders. Lawrence Lessig said that 80% of the films are in the hands of four major holders, rights holders. But probably the same is true for music. Probably the same is true for other sectors. The author, the natural person, when negotiating with the use agents, needs to negotiate with trade unions. The Spanish Constitution and even the competition court in Spain that recognizes the management bodies plays an almost trade unionist role. And of course, in Luxembourg, too, the court has played this role. For example, in the Savant case, in the light of the aforementioned, it's important to note the need to look at the collective management organizations and their role of a monopoly. And this is a natural monopoly at times. When the European Union examined this situation, that there is a collective management in every member state, it looked at it from a dual perspective, from the perspective of competition and from the perspective of the internal market. The internal market aspect was an immediate one. This friction with territorial monopolies of the electricity distribution companies, for example, are natural monopolies because they reduce the costs and they meet market demands in this area. Today, monopolies in distributing electricity are national monopolies, and they run counter to the idea of a common market. And from the perspective of competition, we have to look at a general revision of collective management, a general revision where we would look once again at the efficiency of this national traditional monopoly that characterizes the collective management. And I have to say that calling this into question was because Internet did not involve the transaction costs that justified the monopolies in similar contexts. We didn't have any economic report that explains why, in the digital framework, in the numerical framework, we didn't have those savings in transaction costs, which, however, were justified in the numerical context. Yes, I'm taking advantage of the fact that we have Tillman here. And I can say, why are we having this analysis? We are benefiting from the synergies of the European market, but we're not looking at the advantages that we have in collective management. We have models that are examining this, but they require revision of the requirements insofar as competition is concerned. And I hope that the directive on collective management, the one that Mr. Tillman Luter spoke about, will go along the lines of deriving the greatest benefits from collective management and will take up the major challenges such as those in the European market. And in the discussion, I can talk about some of the lines for this proposal. Thank you very much.
Gracias, Mr. Paolo.
Thank you very much, Pablo. So now we can have a question and answer period. I think that we probably have many questions, so we're waiting for you for your questions. Yes. You have the floor.
Thank you. Ken, is it working? Yeah, okay. Thank you. My name is Albert Pastore with Nokia. And if I may, I'd just like to share Nokia's position for a couple minutes as we operate in some 190 markets. So we have a lot of experience in diverse countries. We've launched our music services in a number of territories around the world, not just EU member states, but also in Russia, Turkey, China, Indonesia, Argentina, Chile, India, Mexico, Brazil, the Middle East, and Northern Africa. So as mentioned, we have quite a bit of experience in diverse markets. There are two requests that Nokia would make to governments here for consideration in order to dynamize the music market and the digital markets in general. First of all, we feel that we need to have licensing frameworks that encourage dynamism, investment, and innovation in the market. We feel in particular this can be achieved by allowing and encouraging and enabling bespoke licensing solutions for new services. So we've already had mention already about streaming and its becoming quite significant in the market. Nokia launched an innovative service allowing unlimited downloads a couple years back, and there will be additional ideas of tomorrow, and we need to find on a continuous basis licensing solutions to allow service providers to bring these new services to market to consumers on a fast and efficient basis. The second request we would make is that we would like further analysis and consideration of regional licensing solutions. For example, we've talked about pan-European licensing solutions. I'm pleased to say on behalf of Nokia that we've also found licensing solutions already for regional parts of Latin America and for the region of the Middle East and North Africa. It's important to remember that there are financial benefits when we find regional licensing solutions. Usually regional services will have greater proceeds in that the whole will be bigger than the sum of the parts. As an example, there's a study that came out from the European Policy Center earlier this year, which indicated that if there existed a digital single market in the EU, there would be a net benefit increase of over 4% of GDP within the whole of the EU, which equals some 500 billion euros of additional revenues, a significant part or a part of which would go to the creative and cultural industries. Within the EU in particular, our vision would be that we would like to see multiple licensors, for example, let's say 8 or 10, offering different repertoires for the whole EU and EEA region. As I believe I heard Tillman say, and as Warner Chappell indicated previously, in our view, one-stop shops do not stimulate the market and will not provide the necessary licensing solutions for the services of tomorrow. Thank you.
Would you like to answer? Would you like to answer, sir?
I just wanted to clarify that I said that a monopoly is perceived by some as not being responsive to consumer demand. Whether you can conclude from that very balanced statement that I don't think that a single licensing shop isn't a good idea is another matter. I think that a certain level of aggregation is necessary. A certain level of repertoire fragmentation has been detrimental, although I have to say that, economically speaking, the fragmented repertoire is at the moment the only one which is licensed beyond a national territory. That's just the reality. You may not like repertoire fragmentation because you think, for other reasons, it's economically inefficient, but in practice, of course, the only pan-territorial licenses that we see are repertoire-specific licenses. So obviously the next step we have to take as the European Commission is to say how can we aggregate these repertoires again, that the pan-territorial licenses are not repertoire-specific, but that they cover a variety of repertoires, maybe not all, because that would be the monopoly, but maybe a large chunk, and we have several licensing centers. On the other hand, I have actually a question now that I have the microphone to Pablo. If collective management, it's a bit of a provocative question, but I think you can handle it. If collective rights management is so efficient and if it has all these kind of cost advantages, why hasn't it been more successful in Europe in terms of actually allowing new internet services to launch?
In Europe, all those who have wanted to initiate something, in the Spanish case, and there's the ones I'm more familiar with, who wanted to launch something in Spain as regards internet services, have done so. I don't think that inefficiency in European terms, in internet services, is due to collective management. But most likely, on the one hand, the very high level of piracy in my country, for example, currently, and persecution of downloading stolen licenses is impossible. There's a whole situation of impunity. It's not prosecuted penally nor civilly. And of course, when water is free, if it's in a bottle, no one's going to pay it, unless the bottle is worth more than the water, but that is not the case. In terms of the remainder of the European market, I think that the companies are going to start initiating services depending on their own on their investment plans. I remember that I negotiated with Nokia. Nokia comes with music launch, and the whole Nokia launches. In many cases, this was determined depending on whether it could be used and what they could obtain in the markets. The remuneration in the market. Spain was a territory which was not a priority one because of the level of piracy. Then the licensing on the part of Nokia was first for territories outside of Spain in that fragmentation, then in Spain. But the commercial decision was depending on what was the investment return and not the difficulty of having access to the repertoire.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to that to express, I don't want to speak about specific countries. Nokia's position, though, for the EU would be ideally for consumers to have access to services once they are launched in the EU, so that, for example, a Finnish consumer would be able to access a British or a Spanish or an Italian service once it's launched in the EU, rather than waiting for the service provider to launch country by country by country, which does, of course, invoke the additional costs and analyses that companies need to make as to whether they launch in a given territory or group of territories. I think several member states and rights holders mentioned today that there was, let's say, a deficiency or an insufficient number of digital services in their territories. And again, by having the possibility of regional launches or regional access to consumers, it makes it even more attractive for service providers to come into diverse territories. And as mentioned, Nokia has launched services in a diversity of territories that include markets where there are high piracy rates, showing that Nokia, as well as other companies, do see potential in those markets through diverse countries, whether in different parts of the world, as I listed before. Thank you.
The gentleman over there? Yes? And afterwards, I'll give you the floor. You have the floor.
Sí.
Carlos González, National Director of Copyright of Paraguay. In truth, in this topic of competition and the granting of licenses in a country such as Paraguay, in a developing country, these are new topics and very interesting topics, which bring us to think about things, to reflection, and particularly the implications that they have and will have in the future. That is, these topics will have in the future. We agree that a single window for the vision that one has on the state side would be interesting for a greater transparency and an equality of opportunity, to put it this way, amongst the rights of right holders and users. Now, also databases in which we've talked about today is very important for the vision that we have. Now, the question for Flavio Arosemena has to deal with the rates. What has occurred is that the matter we're studying is already exists in many countries, and particularly in Latin America. The rates are set in all the countries of Latin America, and I've understood this, and except in Argentina and Chile, because there'd be new modifications there, by the state side, by the state, or by a tribunal. Now, what would be the mechanism? The most appropriate mechanism, taking into account that these are private rights, that of modifying this legislation and then achieving the possibility that it's already the state or an arbitration tribunal which could set these rates. What would be the simplest way for Latin America to achieve this in accordance with Flavio's vision, with the best way to achieve it? Thank you, Carlos. Says Flavio. First, I'd like to stress something which you said right at the beginning of your comments, the single window. I think it's something very healthy, very welcome, because it's different from a single management organization. The single window is the place where I'm going to pay. I'm just going to pay through various collective management organizations. I don't have to receive the visit from each and every one of them. It's a single window, and I think that this is a very good solution. The problem occurs, as you said, when there's just one collective management organization per kind of works, or even several kinds. That is something which is quite natural in small markets. I understand it. I know it occurs because in small markets in Latin America and many European countries, they are small markets. So it's natural that there shouldn't be more than one collective management organization as occurs in the United States. Big markets, so there's several management organizations for types of work, like music. I like the Chilean model, the reform carried out in Chile this year, because I think it's a well-balanced reform. What it says, basically, if there is not an agreement, if the group of users cannot reach an agreement with the collective management organization on what should be a reasonable tariff or rate, then we resort or appeal to an arbitral tribunal. And the collective management organization represented, users are represented, and there's an impartial arbitrational authority. So I think that arbitration is a very good way ahead for the region, and that's what we are familiar with as an alternative, which shouldn't create greater reactions, because what we're saying is let's reach an agreement. And if not, then we'll have an arbitration tribunal, a court. And the legal reason is competition. I agree. The collective management organizations are very specific characteristics organization. They have their special regulations, but they're in a dominant position. That's the reality, particularly when there's just a single organization, and they have complete freedom to set rates as if there's no right to appeal, as exists in many countries, because you consider that the rate is excessive. And that's been a problem. It's been demonstrated to be a problem in our region. So what I would suggest, following the Chilean example, and that's why I brought it over here for you to be familiar with it. That's why I brought it to your attention. Thank you.
Hello, it's David Stops again. Apart from my business interests like artist management and 3DI CD media, I do workshops in developing countries on copyright-related rights and really how to make a living from music. I generally do these workshops for authors and performers, and one of the things I do is I take the top 10 artists in any country and find out how many of them are on iTunes. Generally speaking, only 40% are on iTunes. Now, the problem here is that in somewhere like, say, South Africa, you can't buy iTunes in South Africa. It's not available in South Africa. So it's really off the radar for performers and authors. But it's terribly important. They're on iTunes because iTunes represent 90% of the legal download market in the world. 90. So if you aren't on iTunes, even though it's not available in your country, you're missing out on a major income stream. Now, we also heard from Joe Kennedy this morning about Pandora. It's really important for artists in developing countries to send their music to Pandora, because then it will get played in the USA. And Pandora, of course, Sound Exchange, then collect the money. So then it's really important for performers to be members of Sound Exchange so they can get that income stream as well. So there's a lot of income streams out there for authors and performers that they're not tapping into, particularly in developing countries. And I just wanted to ask John how much money he's holding for performers in developing countries.
I think the issue of performers in developing countries, especially in Africa, where there are not very well-developed collecting societies, is a major issue. We have done a lot of outreach to try to reach some of those performers, whether at WOMEX or at MIDAM or at different music conferences around the world. But it is a significant issue. I have contacted, actually, embassies in the United States, cultural ministers, and saying, can you help me reach this performer or the heirs of a particular performer that I'm aware of from a particular country? It is a significant problem. We have outreach experts who try to reach those folks. Typically, with foreign performers, we're trying to do reciprocal bilateral agreements to make exchanges for all of the performers in a country, but clearly that can't be done in many territories where there are not effective collecting societies. So it is, is it hundreds of thousands? You know, I certainly know there are some African performers owed $15,000 or $20,000 in my database, and some labels as well, independent labels in Africa. So it is a significant problem. It's free to sign up at Sound Exchange to collect your royalties, so there's really no impediment. Anyone is free to sign up, no matter what country they're from. So we, you know, encourage, obviously, people from all over the world, if they don't have a collecting society, to contact us to collect that remuneration. If I could just comment on one other point that was made, I think some of the issue surrounding the lack of the penetration of certain types of services in Europe isn't the fault of collective management. In fact, it's probably that rights holders don't have comfort yet with certain collecting societies to manage those rights, that they'll get fair rates, they'll get high enough rates, and so they withhold the rights. And I think that's been a significant problem around the world.
You had a question before? We have three after you, three speakers after you. I won't forget you. You can may take the floor. Yes, you may.
Una pregunta.
A question. Thank you. Question for Flavio Rosemena. Flavio, the possibility that we resort to an arbitral tribunal if there is no agreement on rates, and normally that applies if the collective management organization has the right to be able to negotiate. But there's a situation where the rights that the user needs to have a concession of a global repertoire, that is not covered by what a society in particular might have. So what is the value that you see for these compulsory licenses to be able to solve the problem of the lack of legal access on the part of the radios, the bodies that need to use globally these repertoires? Thank you, Luis. The point is an excellent one because, of course, with the topic of arbitration, you solve the problem, which is created by the dominant position that a single collective management organization might occupy. But that is not the situation there if the rights are in the private hands. If they're being administered by private entities, not a collective organization, then there wouldn't be that justification because there wouldn't be a dominant position as in the case of a single collective management organization or society. So that, added to the topic we've spoken about today, throughout the day, which is a lack of access in some countries where access is just not available, the work is not legitimately legally available, I think that the compulsory license there is a very good alternative. If the right holder does not put at the disposal of the public the product itself, in other words, the right holder has a reasonable time to be able to put at disposal of the public his product and doesn't do so, then the people of that country have two alternatives. Either they have no access to the music, and that's something that's not going to occur, or they accede to the music illegally. So I think the compulsory license is a way of respecting the international treaties and the copyright law, and that it would enable access. Perhaps it's an alternative, which is a bit drastic, because I'm sure that no right holder really likes to have a compulsory license applied, but it is an alternative which is legitimate and which perhaps might be necessary if the right holder, as I said, does not demonstrate any interest in a certain market, and we can't really compel him to demonstrate interest. So this compulsory license is a way of compensating the rights holder for his work and enable access for the people involved. Thank you.
Merci, Madame la.
Thank you very much, Madam Moderator. Thank you for giving me the floor. Thank you. So I can express a point of view here. I think that since this morning, the discussions we've held demonstrate that it's time to stop here. Time to stop. Because if we continue like this, then it's the whole of humanity which is going to suffer. This morning, I'm trying to imagine a world without creation. I just tell myself it's just not possible. I'm trying to imagine a world without dreams, and that's not possible. So, I've reached the following conclusion. Wouldn't it be better, when we discuss these issues, to first retain the cultural value of the work? I am very bothered when we talk about copyright and competition. It really bothers me because competition is the protection of the investment, but copyright is two things. First, it's the protection of the creation and the protection of the creator. Creator has no interest in creating conditions which would make access to works absolutely impossible. And I'm deeply convinced about that. Any creator has the legitimate ambition to be massively used and seen throughout the whole planet, but of course complying with his rights. So, considering the market aspects, exclusively commercial aspects, I'm just wondering, perhaps I'm going to swim against the current here, but even the technological industry is threatened. Technology is a continent. So that these new businesses, these new economic models, may create as many economies, revenues, but there has to be content, quality content, and diversified quality content at that. So I think that at the time that we are witnessing, here's an invitation I'm giving to everyone. Since this morning, no stakeholders can, if they put themselves in their little corner in isolation, then they can really get anywhere. Technology only has sense and values because there's content. If there's no content, whatever the performance of technology might be, it would be to no avail, no use. The authors as well, they need to be have access to and provide access for users. What I see as a solution, the only solution I see is intellectual property. It being understood that intellectual property at least has three objectives, major objectives. It encourages and promotes creation. It protects because it rewards a creator. But likewise, it provides guarantees for investment because it protects investment. So a system in which you'd only think about investment, 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 is absolutely void and null for the creators, a system that would lead us to a world without dreams, a world where we're just going to go back to our primitive societies. Well, there'd be no more emotion, there would be no more anguish, there'd be no real ambition, no more ambition. So that is what I wanted to say since this morning. I wanted to invite everyone here to engage in more reflection, that we ourselves should stand hand in hand to be able to build a framework, a virtuous framework, in which all the stakeholders would receive guarantees. But if we just think it's technology, then from my point of view, that would be a big, big mistake if we're only thinking about technology, a mistake which in the end would be something very negative for the whole of humanity. Thank you.
Gracias.
Thank you. I don't know if you could please identify yourselves. I forgot to tell you that.
Bueno.
Could you introduce yourselves? First, we have person over there.
Thank you very much. It's Francis Keeling from Universal Music. I was.
Je suis désolée. I'm sorry. My name is Mrs. CB from Senegal, and I manage copyright. I'm a manager of copyright.
Francis Keeling from Universal Music, thank you very much. I think it's incredibly frustrating to hear the level of disconnection in the conversations just now to what is actually going on in the markets. Particularly hearing from Spain, where for the last 5 years we have tried to continually license new partners and find solutions and encourage new investment in services to transform the market from a physical market to a legal digital market. And yet it is failing. It is failing because of the fact that piracy is so bad, there's no support or leadership from the network operators. And ultimately it will mean that there will be no further investment in this fantastic Spanish culture. And how you think that a collective license can fix this is just beyond me. Something we've been trying to license directly, and as a major repertoire owner, it can only make it easier for potential licensors for us to do just that, to license our catalogue as openly and widely as possible. As a record company, we invest hundreds of millions of pounds, euros, dollars, yen, in artists and creating these artists, and the one thing we want to do is to see if we can get a return on that investment and distribute that content as widely and as worldly as we possibly can. In markets where we're not able to do that, where we may not have an economy of scale, we may not have local offices to do that, we will, of course, license third parties, maybe aggregators. And we do that very widely, particularly in Africa, in markets in order to get repertoire out to Senegal, for example. We license aggregators, and it works. It's a model that works incredibly well. In markets which are developing, new markets, emerging markets, are a fantastic opportunity for us. And we've worked with a number of partners to do just that. We work typically with mobile operators to set up content tariffs that give content for free. So, for example, Romania and Eastern Europe, we have many universal-only as well as multiple label partnerships with operators to do that. We've recently partnered with Singtel to create new services in Singapore and Indonesia, and with Qtel to create great new services in the Middle East. Typically, we've never been able to sell a CD or any digital or any product in those markets, and now we have huge growth. In South American countries, again, there is huge thought process and licensing going on with many of the operators and ISPs in South American countries, which we look to see a massive growth area. Why collective licensing could ever be necessary in these markets, certainly from a music standpoint, is beyond me, and why you think that will help the situation. It's about investment, and it's about investment from third parties, and it's about support to try and stop the rot that is piracy. Thank you.
Very quickly, I share what has been said as regards the situation, failure situation, structural failure situation in the Spanish market. The Spanish market is a problem. They don't have norms, standards, which enable us to use or exploit a company in a legal way. It's a problem of the legal framework, which is inefficient, not just in Spain. But if we're looking at the, I received in the last information of income per rights, digital rights, in 25 European countries, there are 10 of them, whose income in terms of management of a copyright is zero. Something is happening. It has nothing to do with the agents, but with the failure of the legal model, which would allow there to be a profitable return. This is not going to facilitate this problem. What it's going to do is that with the other agents, society, Spanish Society of Authors, has a alliance with Universal Inter Alia in Spain, so the situation changed. There is a draft law or bill, which we hope will be approved in January, and will change the situation. Once we have a legal market, then collective management will be beneficial, so that a part of that market, a fair share, will be in the hands of the authors. And in that situation, we will have users, and they will have to put together some conditions which will be appropriate, which will recognize that part of the link in the chain, that fair share of distribution, not just with Universal. On the one hand, that's an ally, and then the other is a consumer of our rights, and they will have to find a fair price. We have no problem with the Universal, nor with the remainder of the agents. But when we will have the legal framework in Spain, which is necessary, so that the business of Universal returns, that's when the collective organization would do its work for Universal and for the authors who belong to that organization. Thank you.
I just quickly want to pick up on the comments made by the director from Senegal. I'm sorry that she's not here right now, because in essence this is an agreement with what I said and what was also said by Pablo. I'm speaking about the entities in Spain, independent entities, and I think it's very important for these internet pages that are also looking at independent Latin American artists to negotiate rights. And the authors principally are authors. And as Senegal said about the copyright today, it's a business right more and more and not an author's right. And it should always be the author who has that right, not the industry. Of course, there may be investment, of course, we're not denying that, but it should be the author. The moderator, I have to apologize to you. As I said when we started the panel, this matter is very controversial, but we have two people who would like to take the floor, and then perhaps you could dialogue later with them. And I do apologize, we don't have any more time for questions now. But after the session, perhaps you could speak about this bilaterally. Now we're going to take up software tailoring licenses to markets.